Welcome to episode 165 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. Today we have an interview with Rick Smolin, a Time, Life and National Geographic magazine photographer, now perhaps better known for his A Day in the Life series of books. Rick is also CEO of Against All Odds Productions, a company that Fortune magazine voted one of the 25 coolest companies in America. So, without further ado, as they say, let's listen to the interview with Rick Smolin. So, Rick, you've led a pretty amazing photographic life, you know, having worked for Time, Life and National Geographic magazines, and there's, you know, then there's your best-selling Day in the Life series of books. I caught you on Iberian X's The Candid Frame podcast recently as well. That was pretty cool. So, you know, a lot of my listeners also, listen to that podcast. But I think, you know, there's probably a good half or so that don't. So if you could sort of explain to us a little bit about how you originally got into photography and everything.
Sure. Well, probably like a lot of your listeners, I'm a passionate amateur photographer to begin with. So, you know, it started out of my own fascination with photography very young. My dad gave me a camera when I was about 16, and I was terminally shy. It was the first time I could talk to girls. I think probably for a lot of male photographers, that was one of the first motivations of getting a camera. I never studied photography formally, but I did the yearbook in high school and college, and was very lucky that right after college, a gentleman who he and his wife ran a little photo agency in Tennessee, and my art professor knew about them, and he said, you know, if you send some of the photographs you've been shooting for the yearbook down to this husband and wife, this fellow's name was Jack Korn, and he and his wife Helen ran this agency, and he said, you know, they will pay you for your photographs. And I said, what do you mean? I'd never heard of stock photography. I knew nothing about the business of photography at all. And he said, well, you know, you could just put a box of 100 pictures that you shot for the yearbook and they would sell them. I said, sell them to who? And he said, well, they would sell them to textbook publishers and, you know, advertisers. So, you know, I sort of naively stuck 100 prints in a box, and to my astonishment, I got a check back about 2 weeks later for $500, which would be like $10,000 today.
Yeah.
So I was hooked. I thought, this is so cool. I get paid for something I love doing. Yeah. And the same gentleman, right after I got out of college, knew the editor of Time magazine and suggested I go up there. And I went up there naively with my yearbook under my arm. And, you know, at the age of 24, got hired by Time magazine. Wow. And interesting that Martin, you live in Japan, because one of my first assignments was the first nonstop Pan Am flight from New York to Tokyo. It was a press junket, and none of my professional friends wanted to go because it was beneath them. and I was this young kid I literally had one camera body, two lenses, a 24 and a 105. Mm. I had never shot color before. Mm-hmm. And some of my friends, a fellow named Dirk Halstead, who now runs the Digital Platypus and the Digital Journalist, it's a wonderful website. Mm-hmm. Basically, he gave me the ticket, and I went over. I left on a Monday thinking I was coming back on Friday, and I stayed for 11 months. I fell in love with Japan, with Asia. I got, you know, Time magazine found out I was there on this press junket and said, while you're there, would you do this assignment and that assignment. So, you know, in between assignments, I learned also from Dirk Halstead one of the most important things in my career, which is the word barter. Dirk told me that I could go to hotels and airlines and rental car companies and offer to trade them my photographic services for free rooms and free cars and free flights.
Yeah.
And I'd never heard of this before. And to my astonishment, I'd go in there with my, you know, little pictures from Time magazine, and all the hotels had extra rooms, and the airlines were not full, and so I was able to trade my, you know, budding photographic skills for the ability to travel around Asia pretty much for free. I've probably been to Japan over 100 times on you know, first on assignments. And then later on, I printed the majority of my books in Japan, and I just love the place. I've hitchhiked around Japan, which is probably pretty unusual for a gaijin.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And I made many friends there, both Japanese friends and expats from all over the world. Yeah. Martin, one of the things that I've always loved about being a photojournalist is this sense of camaraderie that even if I'm shooting for Time and you're shooting for Newsweek, yeah. you know, when we're out there shooting, we're trying to outdo each other. But when we're not shooting, it's sort of a big family, and it's the people you hang out with and spend your time with and complain to and share tips yeah. with. And I love that feeling of just arriving in a country that I've never been to before, and all of a sudden here are 15 people that I met, you know, five times before in other places.
Yeah, yeah. And I love that part of photography too. People, you know, some people are secretive with their, you know, the locations and their techniques and things, but you know, I find that a lot of people just share it and kind of pass on the knowledge and the, you know, the know-how, and it just makes it so much easier to get by, and, you know, all of that camaraderie, as you say.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things, particularly about, you know, the photojournalist world, and maybe this is true of all photographers, but I find it especially true of photojournalists. And I'm probably one of the worst examples or best examples of it, which is I think I've always joked that photojournalism is the world's finest form of delayed adolescence. a lot of my friends who are in their 50s could easily be mistaken, at least emotionally, for people in their teens. I'm not sure it's a very attractive quality when you're in your 50s, but nevertheless, I think there's always been this you know, a lot of photographers, like children, are your best friend while they're with you.
Yeah.
You know, they make friends very easily. They're very charming. They're sort of benevolent con men and women. Yeah. Because, you know, your job is not just to take the photograph, but it's to get past the guards into the palace to take the photographs. Mm. So a lot of times I've found that there are some people that may not be the best photographers in the world, but they are utterly charming human beings who are able to, you know, get in and out of places that many people can't.
Yeah.
And likewise, you know, spending time with photographers, they have that sort of childlike openness and fascination and curiosity about other people. They want to know people's stories, and I think people are complimented by that.
Yeah, definitely.
There's tens of thousands of photographers in the world, but at least when I was out there as a photojournalist, when I started the Day in the Life books, it seemed to be around 100 people that were considered to be the best that were out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was always the baby of the group. I was always kind of honored that they took me under their wing. And I certainly didn't ever think I was one of the 100, but I liked hanging out with 100. And one day I was sitting in a bar in Bangkok with Philip Jones Griffiths and J.P. LaFont, and you know, Philip was from Magnum and JP was from Sigma. A lot of the photographers had gathered themselves into agencies. I was with Contact. And, you know, we were all sitting around this bar, and everybody was complaining, as usual, about their editors. And now they didn't know a good picture from a hole in the ground, and they never chose the right pictures. And you know, as the youngest of everybody out there, I was always kind of stunned that all they did was sort of bitch and moan. And I said, guys, you know, I feel so lucky to be out here. I'm getting paid $400 a day. I'm renting Learjets. I'm meeting presidents and prime ministers and seeing the world at somebody else's expense. And, you know, I pick up Time magazine and there's a picture I shot last week. There's 4 million copies of it with my name under it.
Yeah.
I mean, what could be better than that? And they'd all, I realized after a while what it was that was getting everybody so upset was that the photographers would get very emotionally involved in the stories they were shooting. And I think we all felt, you know, hope, I mean, at least at the beginning of our careers, I think we all felt that if we photographed some injustice or people that were disadvantaged or something that we felt needed to be exposed, that the simple act of our pictures being published would somehow change that situation, that once people saw the photographs, they wouldn't just, you know, sit back. Now, you know, obviously pictures like Abu Ghraib and Eddie Adams' picture of the street shooting in Saigon and, you know, Nick Ood's picture of the girl being, you know, napalmed in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Those are all pictures that you can point to them and say that when the public saw those pictures, the politicians couldn't lie to us anymore. There was no arguing. with what you were seeing. And I think that's true of those photographs. But unfortunately, I think for better or worse, a lot of journalism was and is today a very bizarre form of entertainment. Even when the pictures are horrible and of great injustice is being done, the people look at them and kind of think, well, gee, I'm glad that's not happening to me.
Yeah.
But there isn't this immediate, and I'm going to do something about it.
Yeah.
So I think that was a lot of the frustration. So, you know, here all these editors, all these photographers bitching and moaning. And I said, you know, wouldn't it be cool, guys, if we could all go to a country and spread ourselves out around the country for 24 hours? And, you know, obviously there'd be lots of research done in advance to make sure that people weren't just doing street photography. But this idea of a project organized by photographers, edited by photographers, you know, laid out, designed, blah, blah, blah. And so all my friends said, what a great idea. You go organize it and we'll all come.
Yeah.
So I went off knowing nothing as usual about what I was doing. I knew nothing about photography when I started, and I knew nothing at all about book publishing. And I went to 35 publishers thinking they would fall over the brilliance of this, you know, idea of 100 photographers, the best in the world, let loose for 24 hours.
Yeah.
And they laughed me out of their office. I met with 35 publishers who just said, Rick, you know, what a stupid idea. Why would anybody – first of all, you obviously know nothing about book publishing. I said, that's true. And they said, there's no market for coffee table books. Nobody in the world would be interested in a bunch of pictures taken by your friends in some godforsaken country. I was proposing Australia because that's where I was living at the time.
Yeah.
So I went to the Prime Minister of Australia, who I had photographed many times, and he was always very gracious to me, and he liked photographers. I think he was quite jealous of freedom that photographers had versus, if you think of most politicians' lives and how every minute of their day is planned and scheduled weeks in advance, and the word spontaneity doesn't even exist in their world, and then they watch us. You know, where no 2 days are the same, and we kind of make up our own schedules and kind of, you know, for better or worse, you know, kind of very undisciplined, except, you know, when you're actually shooting. So this guy, I think, had a real kind of, envy and fondness for photographers. So I went to see him and I said, look, I want to do this book, A Day in the Life of Australia. And I've met with all these publishers and they won't support it. You know, do you think the Australian government could like put up the funds for it? Cause it'll be great for your country. And he kind of laughed at me and said, you know, nice try. He said, but I will help you. And I said, yeah. And he goes, no, listen. He said, I will help you. And I said, okay. You know, I think he was just sort of shining me on. And he said, first of all, I'm going to give you a letter saying that I know you, I admire your photography, that, you know, that I encourage people to support your project. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, thanks. You know, not really realizing it is actually pretty cool to have the Prime Minister of a country, you know, giving you a letter, but I didn't really think it was going to make much difference since all the publishers had turned down the idea. And he said, no, he said, okay, but here's the thing that's really going to help you. I said, okay, if you're not giving me money, I can't imagine what's going to help me, but I'll listen. And he said, okay, Rick, just like stick with me here for a second. Listen, he said, you're going to meet with the heads of companies, with the CEOs of companies all over Australia, and you're going to tell them that you're producing the Olympics of photography. I said, what does that mean? He goes, okay, look, you're inviting, you know, 100 photographers from 30 different countries. You know, you tell me it's a collaboration, but I know you guys have been around you and you're all trying to screw each other. You're all trying to get the best picture and elbow the other guy out of the way. And he said, you know, I have no doubt you're all going to be, this is a competition, no matter what you're calling it. And if you go to private companies, maybe they'll give you, you know, airline tickets and hotels and of course, you know, as I said, Dirk Halstead had planted this seed in my mind already about sponsorship. So with the Prime Minister's letter of endorsement, he opened a bunch of doors. I went to see Qantas. I actually went and saw Steve Jobs, you know, back in the States before, you know, it was when the very beginning of Apple. And to my astonishment, everybody not in publishing said, what a cool idea. Gosh, the best photographer in the world let loose in our country. You know, the Australians also – who I adore the Australians. Some of my best friends are Australian, but there had been, this is, you know, 30 years ago, a little bit of an inferiority complex. I mean, it was almost like we were the big brother, they were the little brother, England was the parent. And there was this sort of, you know, there's always this tremendous affection between Americans and Australians. And I think Australians felt like the world didn't know them. So the fact that we were going to bring all these famous photographers to put a sort of shine a light on their culture. You know, we photographed, Mel Gibson when he was doing Mad Max. And it was in the early days of the film industry down there as well. So anyway, I had no cash. I couldn't pay the photographers, but I managed to get 100 first class round trip tickets, and we got cars and computers, and families all over Australia agreed to put the photographers up. And I couldn't find a publisher, so I had to actually self-publish the book, which was terrifying because I'd gotten to a point where I realized unless this book was a bestseller, I was going to go to jail. I had no way of paying any of the bills. I had no cash at all, and we had 30 people on our staff sleeping on a floor in Melbourne in sleeping bags, and it was really terrifying. It was literally like jumping out of an airplane and hoping you could build a parachute on the way down. And I guess that's a good motivation. And in fact, I find that like a lot of people, I'm an adrenaline junkie. So unfortunately, I actually am much better when I'm scared to death. And the book became the number one book in Australia, self-published. It was the first time in history. It sold 200,000 copies in a market where 5,000 was a bestseller. The Prime Minister actually asked if he could be one of the photographers. Of course, that great publicity, because then we ended up on every TV show and every newspaper. And I had no intention, Martin, of becoming a publisher or a packager or an organizer of events. I love photography, and I had no – I didn't want to give up being a journalist. I just thought it would be fun to do this one book. Yeah. But the book was so successful that we started getting calls from other countries. We got a call from the King of Spain saying, hey, we saw your book and we lost Disneyland to the French. We have this budget. Can we give it to you? It's like, yes, thank you, Lord. Gorbachev saw the book we did when we did Day in Life of America. The governor of Hawaii saw the book and wanted us to come celebrate their 25th anniversary of statehood. So we ended up, doing this incredible series, and there were, it was like the annual gathering of the tribe, marriages and divorces and babies. And, it was a young woman who I was sharing a house with. She wasn't my girlfriend. She was just a very close friend. Fell in love with one of the photographers on the first book, a wonderful photographer named Greg Heisler.
Yeah.
And I invited them both to dinner, during the week because I was living in her house and Greg was interesting, and we had a bunch of photographers at dinner. And about 3 days later, I was walking through King's Cross, and there was Greg and Prue holding hands. And I thought, oh, that's so sweet, And they came up, and Greg said, what are you doing this afternoon? And I said, I'm editing. This is right after the shoot. Yeah. And he said, well, are you available to attend a wedding? And I said, whose wedding? He said, we're getting married. And this is 3 days after they met. And so I was both best man and wedding photographer. And they're still happily married. They have two adorable children. And, I don't know if you know Greg's work, but he's one of the most amazing photographers in the world. He was back then, and he was just getting started. So this has sort of been like my family and my life all these years. I got pretty sick of doing the Day in the Life books after a while, because by about the ninth book, it felt like, one trick pony. And I was very interested in how technology enables photographers to tell their stories. I moved to California. I wanted to be close to people like Steve Jobs and the people starting at Adobe and then later eBay and Google. And we've been able to continue getting sponsorship for our projects. But instead of doing countries, we've been doing topics like medicine or microprocessors or the global water crisis. My wife, Jennifer Irwitt, and I have been partners for many years producing these books. And her dad is the great photographer, Elliot Irwitt, who was my hero growing up since I was 16. And he's still a very active photographer. Do you know his work?
Not that much, but I've seen some of it, and I totally agree. It's amazing.
Yeah, he actually comes to Japan a lot. He's also with Magnum. Just incredibly, his photographs are like New Yorker cartoons. They're very funny. And, any of your listeners who are interested, he was my total inspiration as a young photographer. When I was about 30, I went up to him at an exhibit the third time I'd met him, and of course he never remembered me. You know, why would he? This beautiful young girl walked up while I was talking to him, and that was his daughter. And,
so your current wife?
Yes, my only wife, current wife, and we have two little kids. Jesse is 6 and Phoebe's 8.
Yeah.
Which is why I was a little bit late tonight getting to you for this interview.
No problem.
We're in New York City for Thanksgiving vacation.
I see. And
visiting family and friends. But my daughter went for her first sleepover last spring. And there was a little girl down the street from our house. And she was very nervous about it. You know, what teddy bear should I take? And will you come get me in the middle of the night if I'm scared? This is like 3 houses away. This is, you know, a place she plays after school every day, but it was a sleepover, so it was a big deal.
It's a big adventure.
So the next morning I went and picked her up, and you know, she survived, and we were walking back holding hands, and I said, "So Phoebe, what's the one thing you're going to remember for the rest of your life that you'll never forget about your first sleepover?" And she leaned over and kind of whispered, she said, "Dad, did you know that other people's lives are different than ours?" I said, "I kind of suspected that, but what do you mean?" She said, "You know, Charlotte's mother let us eat Cheerios for dinner, for, you know, dessert. And, you know, her father read, you know, stories to us under the covers with a flashlight." And she said, "You know, do you remember your first sleepover?" I said, "Phoebe, you know, it's been so long since." And I suddenly had this memory that I swear I've never had since I was, you know, 7 or 8 years old. And she could see it on my face. She said, "What? What were you thinking?" I said, "Phoebe, that's so weird. I have never thought about this before." And she said, "What? What?" I said, I just remembered, just like you, I went for a sleepover to this little boy. I lived in an apartment building in New York. And, I was very nervous. And I went to his house for a sleepover. And we were sitting down at dinner. And just as I was about to put a fork of meatloaf in my mouth, she said, "What's meatloaf?" And I said, it's food that we used to eat in the 60s. I looked around, and the whole family had closed their eyes, and they were holding hands, and they were praying. And I said, "You know, we didn't do that in my family before we ate. You know, it just wasn't a tradition in my family." And she said, "What did you think?" I said, "Well, I just suddenly, like you, realized, oh my gosh, you know, everybody has things that are the same but different about what the traditions and rituals and ceremonies and, you know, the things they do in their house." And she said, "Dad, you and Mom should do a book about how people's lives are the same but different in their houses."
I
thought, wow, what an interesting idea. Just this idea of like a 1-week look at all the ways that people kind of transform their dwellings into their homes, you know, the emotional homes.
Yeah.
So we did this book called America at Home, which has come out a few months ago, and it's done very well. And one of the things about it that people really like, both professional photographers who worked on it and professional photographers who didn't, as well as amateurs, is that you can actually upload your own photograph to our website.
I saw that.
And when you get the book, you're actually on the cover.
Yeah, that's so cool.
And it doesn't look like a cheap Xerox. It looks like a real – it looks, you know, it's the logo superimposed over your photograph. It's the reviews from the Today Show and CNN, and people have just gone crazy over this.
Yeah, you know, I've not got a copy yet, but I'm going to order one. I'm looking forward to getting that, the personalized photo on the front. It's definitely, you know, I mean, it's like I was looking at that, and I'd read that, you know, one of your books in the 90s was the first one to have a CD included.
Yes.
And, you know, and you're, it seems, you know, probably one of the main reasons for your success is that, you know, you think of these things that are just like so innovative, and it's new, it's fresh. And I thought that was just such a great angle to come at this from.
Well, I mean, as I said, I'm really interested. I love technology. I'm a junkie for this stuff. I think that some of the technology that's out there actually helps us as photographers tell the stories better. So whether it's a CD where you can, you know, give, you know, at the time it was before the internet. So we were able to actually let you feel like — I did a book called From Alice to Ocean.
Yeah.
It was about a young woman who spent 8 months crossing the outback of Australia with 4 camels and a dog.
Yeah.
And so I'm shooting for National Geographic like every photographer, I shot, you know, tens of thousands of pictures. I think I had 150,000 pictures of her trip. And the Geographic published it, but I felt like it was such a tiny representation of what I had experienced.
Yeah.
And the Geographic wasn't particularly interested in what I experienced. I was there as a photographer, but I thought that doing a book about it would be great. But then I was hearing about this thing called interactive CDs.
Mm.
So Apple and Kodak both kindly provided technology and funding. So we actually put two CDs in the book that let you feel like you were actually going on the adventure with her. You could hear her telling you the story. You could ask me, you know, how I took the pictures and get tips. You could learn about plants and animals of the outback or about Aboriginal culture. And now with the web, have you seen Brian Storm's website, MediaStorm?
I haven't, no.
It's a wonderful, wonderful website where, you know, Brian is taking photographer stories and adding, you know, their narration and sort of Ken Burns kind of, you know, pan and zoom through the still photographs and just giving you a much richer experience than you would just simply looking at the photographs.
Yeah, I'll check that out.
It's sort of ironic that as major outlets for photography like Life magazine and Look, and all these magazines that I grew up with are gone now.
Yeah.
And yet on the internet, there's sort of infinite space, but most of my friends are photographers are not making a lot of money doing, you know, interactive storytelling. It's more satisfying in many ways, but so far it hasn't been very profitable. Mm. I hope that's going to change.
I think it's a lot of it. It's like me with the podcast. I mean, it takes a lot of time and, you know, the websites, the community that sprung up around it, you know, it's more about, I mean, obviously I enjoy doing that. I enjoy sharing the knowledge that I've gained from others. But I mean, you know, you have to be honest, or at least I have to be honest, that a lot of the reason that I started that is just for the marketing value and
sure.
You know, trying to get your name out there. And I've definitely become much better known since doing that. You know, I'm getting more work and, you know, selling more prints and things like that. So it's definitely that's what it's all about, I think.
I think also think sometimes you just do something because you're passionate about it.
And
the money follows, you know. For a lot of photographers, I think I certainly always felt incredibly lucky to get paid for doing something I just love doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's easy to say that when you're, you know, 23 years old. It's a little different when you're, you know, when you got a family.
Yeah. Well, I agree, you know, that without having the passion there, I mean, I definitely wouldn't have continued doing what I've done. It's been almost over 3 years now. And it's a big chunk of my life that I've donated to that. So it's definitely the passion that keeps me going. But, you know, it's just like there's definitely initially and even now, some of the part of what keeps me going is just the fact that it's helping to get my name out there. And I'm sure that, you know, obviously with MediaStorm, that's probably not as necessary. But I'm sure that there are these sort of benefits that we get from doing this sort of charity work on the internet to a degree.
Sure. And I think, you know, inevitably, the financial models follow a lot of the creativity. I think one of the hardest things right now for photographers is that there are so many good photographers out there, and the internet makes it pretty easy to get your work seen.
Yeah,
and you know the whole rise of micro stock has kind of really put a huge crimp in the earning ability of a lot of professional photographers because there are, I don't think micro stock is anywhere near what you would get from, you know, top level professional photographers. But for a lot of people, either they don't know the difference or they don't care. And, you know, a picture, you know, I don't think pictures are interchangeable at all, but I think to some picture buyers, they're maybe not as discriminating as they used to be.
Yeah, for sure. You've got to have something in addition to just good photography these days to make a living at it, without a doubt.
Right, and as I said before, you know, to me, a lot of being a good photographer is being able to get past all the obstacles and into the situations to take the photographs.
Yeah.
Do you travel around Asia a lot?
Not a lot. I was in China last week. I was thinking when you were saying that earlier, it was pretty funny. I shot a portrait of a soldier in the Forbidden City towards the end of the day. And I got a really wonderful sort of a grin or a smirk from him just from being cheeky enough to walk up with a 135 millimeter lens and stick it in his face and say, can I take your photo? And the the exchange that we had there, there was, I think it was a guy probably superior to him that was over there saying, no photo, no photo. And I was just smiling and laughing, and they were laughing back, and they were saying, just take the photo. And, you know, not saying that, but mentally I could tell that was what it was all a joke. And yeah. I think that just the sort of personalities that were involved in that sort of three-way interaction helped me to just say, you know, oh, look, I'm just going to take it. And I raised the camera, snapped it, and I got a wonderful photo of this young guy with a great, you know, look on his face. And I think it's one of those things that you've just got to – if I was there with like a straight face, sullen look and that, I wouldn't have got that photo. So, you know, definitely just sort of being a little bit cheeky and sort of trying to get past things is definitely necessary, I think.
I remember when I was just first starting as a photographer, someone had said to me that you know, if someone gets upset at you for photographing, you know, the worst thing you can do is to slunk away. Mm. That the best thing to do is just to, you know, walk over. And even if you don't speak their language, yeah. And I've done this my whole life pretty much, is, you know, if somebody's obviously upset, and I get 99% of the time, the reason people get upset is they think you're making fun of them. They feel somehow that you've done something to them. And so I always walk, and when you walk up to somebody, instead of looking guilty, if you smile, as you were just describing, you walk over to them, even if you don't speak a word of their language, if you say, you know, you look just like my grandmother, and, you know, you use sign language, you know, you touch your face, and people can hear from the tone of your voice that you're saying something nice.
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't feel like that you were doing something to ridicule them. I really think 90% of the time, it's simply somebody feeling like you were doing something that hurt them in some way, you know, or was making them feel smaller.
Yeah, yeah, totally agree. So, you know, I was curious, you know, you did your latest book, America at Home, in conjunction with a shoot in the UK, right?
So yes.
Like the UK at home. And obviously,
yes.
with me coming from the UK originally, that kind of, you know, got me thinking. And I was just wondering how it came about to do the two together.
Well, it's funny, you know, after we started working on the America book, we were trying to think of who would be potential sponsors, because, you know, our projects cost literally millions of dollars to do. Mm. And, you know, flying 100 photographers around, months of research, building the website. There's so many things that go into it. And we pay the photographers pretty well now as well. So we thought of all the companies in the world that sort of were associated with the concept of home and who might be a likely candidate. And IKEA is a company that I have always just loved. I mean, I like going to the Apple store, and I like going to the IKEA store. It's yeah. like a fun outing. Yeah. Even if I'm not really looking for anything, it's just I like the creativity. I like the fact it's affordable. So we went, we met with the head of IKEA in the United States, and they just fell in love with the idea. And one of the things I was really happy about was that they actually said we would prefer not to have any of our products in the book. Mm. And usually that's the first thing I say to sponsors, is that we're not going to do product placement, because the moment you do that, then the whole book becomes suspect.
Yeah.
They simply wanted to be associated with the concept of home. They've been very successful in the United States and thought this was a cool present to give back, especially the custom cover. Mm. And then their counterparts in the UK heard about it and said, well, we want one too. And I said, well, why don't we do America, and then we'll do you guys, you know, the next year. And then they said, well, no, we actually – you know, we're releasing this new campaign, which is called Home is the Most Important Place in the World. And could you do us at the same time? Well, you know, it's hard enough to do one of these projects in one country, let alone trying to do the logistics for two at the same time.
I can imagine.
So we were very lucky. Sergey Brin at Google is a friend, and actually invited us to move into Google's offices in London. And so we our whole staff lived at Google, and everyone gained about 15 pounds, because they they feed you incredibly well there. I mean, it's this open cafeteria night and day. But, you know, they basically don't want their employees to ever leave, so they make it very hospitable. And they gave us offices and computers and desks. And we were really thrilled when Paul McCartney's daughter agreed to work on the project. And then we asked her if she would ask her father if he would consider writing the introduction to the book, thinking, you know, he would never do it, because he's known for not lending his name to things at all. Mm. And to our astonishment, he actually said yes. So in the United States, Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons, wrote the introduction. Yeah. There's some wonderful essays by Amy Tan and David Pogue, one of my favorite technology writers, and Dominique Browning from House and Garden magazine. And in England, we had Simon Winchester and Alain de Botton and many other writers. It just the book to your listeners. This is not just a book of photographs. You first of all, I think they're great photographs in both America at home and UK at home. But great essays, and then there's some really fascinating and funny and thought provoking statistics. Some of the ones in America that I love are 50% of men, 80% of men would remarry their wives, but only 50% of wives would remarry their husbands. The majority of Americans live within 50 miles of where they were born.
Yeah.
20% of all American school children today are growing up in families that speak a language other than English at home. Just things like that, that you really go, wow, these are things that I had no idea before we did this book, where it's not just a nice collection of photographs. And we talked about the housing crisis. We actually had a photographer accompany a policeman who was actually evicting people from their homes, which he was very sad about, but he was basically hired to do this. And so here's a poor woman being thrown out of her house, and then a photograph next to it is a two children who live in a they play in a $10,000 playhouse in the backyard, which has electricity in it. I think they had air conditioning. And it's a little miniature replica of their parents' home. And it wasn't to mock one or ridicule the other. It was simply to show
irony, right?
Well, it's the irony, and it's just astounding diversity of how many different ways Americans live. They live on houseboats. Mm. They live under we showed people living under cardboard boxes in Manhattan. And again, it wasn't a drive-by photography. We knew the name of the person. We knew what they did, where they went to school, as much as we could figure out about why they became homeless. So their story was treated with the same respect that we treated anybody else in the book. It wasn't simply, oh, we're going to show a homeless person to say that we did it. And I just think it's really important that you really feel like you just were invited into the homes or boxes or sheds of several hundred people and invited to wander around inside those homes.
Yeah, yeah. So I was looking, as I say, I don't have a copy of the book yet, or the UK or the America one. But I was looking. I thought it was also really cool that you've got a number of pages that you can see inside. I do suggest that anyone that's considering buying a copy of either book, just go over to the website. I'll put some links in the show notes for the podcast as well. But I thought it was cool that you could look inside the book, and I think there's something like 20 pages or more for each book. The point I was trying to get to here was that I was pretty amazed at the quality of the images. When I first heard of the project, I was thinking, obviously that you're using top class photographers to do a lot of this, and some amateurs as well, I believe. But the fact that you're using top class photographers should have told me that you're going to have high quality photography in there. But for some reason, I didn't think it was going to be that good. But when I looked, the shots are imaginative. They're from inventive angles. It's got good lighting. They're all even. They're top class photographs. So,
Also, Martin is and I always hate to say this when I have photographers listening, which is, as much as our projects are photography driven, I think they're very much made by the editors. I think, looking at hundreds of thousands of pictures and choosing the 250 that end up in the book, is just incredibly important. We had Eric Miskowskis, who used to be director of photography at the New York Daily News, and Karen Malarkey, who's been the director of photography for many of our projects, and a whole host of other editors from Time and from Geo and the Daily the Daily News in New York. Anyway, we had a lot of terrific editors who helped make sense out of. How do you tell the story in a way that really surprises the reader? So thank you for the comments. I appreciate it. Also, by the way, if any of your listeners are in the United States, as I imagine many are, We have a special for the holidays that we're offering $10 off. So you get the book for $30 instead of $40 with a free wraparound cover that we normally charge $15 for. Mm. So it's a great deal. And all you have to do is go to our website, which is www.myamericaathome.com.
Yeah.
When you get to the checkout part of the, after you make your cover, you just put in the code, it's holiday08.
Holiday08, okay.
Yeah. Or follow08, either one of those will work.
Is it case sensitive at all or just holiday?
No, it's not.
Okay. It's holiday. So everybody that wants to pick up a book, and hopefully there'll be lots of you. Excuse me. Don't forget that code.
Actually, tell your listeners, just use fall 08. That's the easiest way to do it.
Okay, fall 08. I won't put that in the show notes because that's searchable. So you've got to listen. Okay. You've actually got to listen to get that. Okay. I was going to ask one of the other questions that I was thinking of asking you was about the editing. You've just sort of, answered the majority of that. What I wanted to follow up with there was, this is your project. I understand that there's a lot of people that help you, but do you sort of have the last say at the final cut of the 250 or so that make each book?
It's a little bit like a communist election, which is, I weigh in very heavily, as does my wife, Jennifer, about what ends up in the book, but we also pay a lot of attention to what the editors say during the edit. I mean, everybody, we project all the images, we all discuss them. So if there's a picture I love and everybody else says that picture sucks, it may just remind me of, maybe the person in the picture reminds me of somebody I know. It's very subjective, what you like about a picture, what you don't. Brad Zukroff, who was the designer of both American Home and UK at Home, basically, locked himself in a room for a week with each book. It sort of came out with his edit, and then we sort of, tore it apart a few times, went back and forth, and then, it is a series of compromises, I guess, ultimately, because it's our company, we could sort of force things if we wanted to, but the goal here is to have the book be as interesting as it can be the largest number of people. So I pay a lot of attention to our designers and picture editors because I think that's really their skill. I still think of myself as a photographer.
Yeah, yeah. Do any of your photographs make the book these days? Do you actually shoot for it yourself as well?
I do, and it's sort of the calm in the eye of the storm for me. It's one day I don't have to worry about anybody else except myself. I miss being a photographer a lot. I love the spontaneity of it. And I love sort of watching life unfold in front of you. And unfortunately, running a company and doing these projects, you got to be planning, 6 months to a year ahead. Yeah. So I feel a little bit like my friend, the old Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, who, everything was sort of set up for him way in advance and he had to keep thinking, sort of it had to be thinking five steps ahead. It's more lucrative, but it's certainly not as much fun as being a photographer, but I guess that's, stages you go through in your life. I think probably being a record producer is better than being a band, unless you are the hot band at the moment, So it's a little bit like that. I do photograph my kids a lot and I photograph my friends. And when my friends get married, I tell them to hire a real wedding photographer, but then I try to give them a National Geographic wedding, something they can't buy anywhere.
Yeah.
But, if I'm lucky, I get a few of my pictures, in my own books, but I try to, I actually put my pictures in anonymously.
I see.
So that when the editors are going through, they're not looking at them saying, oh, we better select this because Rick's paying us.
Yeah.
Actually want to actually see if it makes it through the edit without it being sucking up to the owner of the company.
that's pretty cool. So on your company, I had a couple of questions. One of them's a little bit cheeky, but the name of your company is Against All Odds Productions, right?
Yes.
Silly question, but when you named your company, did it have anything to do with the Phil Collins song from the movie?
No, it's funny. I love the movie, and I actually got to meet Jimmy Woods, who's the bad guy in the movie. You know, Jeff Bridges and Rachel Ward. But I actually named it because every time we do one of our projects, especially when they involve complicated technology, people always say to us, "That'll never work. That's a stupid idea." You know, you'd think after all these years, people would say, "Oh, well, you've been pretty successful in the past. Maybe this is a valid idea." But I find that I'm still always swimming upstream, especially with publishers. So I just thought it was a funny name, and it makes people laugh. And I get bored really easily, so I actually like, as I said, I like being slightly terrified. I think sometimes we purposely complicate our lives along the way.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
Yeah. So anyway, I like projects that have that sense of, against all the obstacles and actually adding things in our way to make it more interesting.
Yeah, so cool. So you were voted by, or your company was voted by Fortune magazine as like one of the 25 coolest companies in America. I can already guess because of everything I've heard and in our conversation today, but what do you think contributed to being selected for that award or recognition?
I think it's because we've had a history of being sort of ahead of the curve in publishing. I mean, we were the first people to ever do a self-published, number one book. And a lot of people credit the Day in Life books for having kind of pioneered or turned the category of coffee table books into actual mass market. It used to be, if you could sell a few thousand, that was a big deal. We probably sold 5 million books now of these illustrated books, which apparently was not the case before. Again, I knew nothing about any of this. I didn't know we were setting a precedent. I was just desperately trying to keep my head above water and not go to jail, which is, to a man who's facing a hanging, is a huge motivation there. Things like, I think we were the first people to ever design a coffee table book on the computer, again, because of our relationship with Apple. First people to put an interactive CD into a book. We did a project called 24 Hours in Cyberspace, where we did a live event on the internet and built the website in real time with 150 photographers around the world, showing how the internet was beginning to touch civilization and affect people's lives. And the website from that ended up becoming the first website to go into the Smithsonian as a piece of their archive. So, I think Fortune was reacting, and now the custom covers. And we used to actually pay the photographers with Macintosh computers. So, Steve, we were actually living in Japan at Apple. Apple gave us office space. It seems to be a tradition. Now it's Google. Then it was Apple. Mm. And Steve came to Japan and walked into our offices there and not realizing that some of his staff had actually given us part of their office, had extra office space. And he said, "What are you guys doing here?" And I said, "Well, we're doing these books." And long story short is I ended up asking him if he would let us buy Macintoshes from him at cost and give them to all the photographers, which astoundingly he said yes to. And those were the first Macintoshes that ended up coming in the back doors at Time and Newsweek and National Geographic and Fortune.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think Fortune just felt like we've been consistently on the cutting edge of publishing technology, storytelling, not just doing nice, pretty photo books.
It seems so true. So, we're coming up to like 50 minutes. I wanted to ask one thing before we finished. If you could give one single piece of advice to a budding photographer, maybe someone hoping to make their living at this game, and other than don't do it, what would it be?
I guess the biggest advice I give people is to find something that you're find something to photograph that you are very emotionally attached to, whether it's kids or some situation needs to be fixed, or it's horses, or I'm just making this up, but I'm just saying that the thing that editors want to see when you walk into their office is not that you're a hired gun, but that you're able to take a concept and fully explore it with your camera. That the way you look at it, that you give the editor an incredible variety of choice of how you were able to illustrate the subject matter. Because inevitably, if you want to be a photographer and you want to work for magazines, the editor is going to look at you and say, are you going to make him or her look good to their boss?
Yeah.
So a lot of times what people want is not necessarily brilliance, but that you show that you're able to kind of think about something in a very broad, multifaceted way.
Yeah.
And I know that I came back and saw editors many, many times before I started getting work. And every time I came to them, I showed them another story that I'd shot for myself.
Mm.
And I remember an editor saying, you know, wow, if you work for me as hard as you work for yourself, you're going to do great. And I think that that's probably the best advice I can give is if you are obsessive about what you do and you're passionate about it, eventually you'll find people that will support you, because it's hard to find people that don't take no for an answer and that, you know, against all odds, just keep persevering. So, you know, I can't help taking pictures, and most of my friends are good photographers. You know, they live and breathe photography. It's all they think about.
Yeah.
And I think if you're like that, inevitably you're going to find a way to make your living at it. It may be that you should just keep it as a hobby and not, you know, sometimes doing what you love can ruin it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a big consideration too.
Yeah.
That's probably my biggest advice.
Yeah. That's great advice. So, it's been great talking to you, Rick. Thanks for the opportunity to do the interview. And
thank you.
Not at all. You know, it's, and sorry, I think I've kept you up pretty late. You're on the opposite side of your continent tonight from when we set this up.
So. Usually in San Francisco, but yeah, we're back here for a week just to be with friends and family for Thanksgiving. We were sitting around at dinner last night and everybody was saying that even though we all feel beaten up, I think we're all reminding ourselves how lucky we are to, you know, be doing things that we love. And you know, there's a lot of unfortunate things happening in the world right now. And I think times like this actually make people reach out and look after other people more. So I hope we're certainly doing that with our family. And I'm encouraging all my friends to kind of think of people out there that are having trouble right now getting by and seeing if there's some way of just extending a little help until we all pull through this.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess you'll be back to the grindstone next week. Have you got a few more days holiday before you go back?
Yeah, I'm going to actually be going back the week after next. And it's nice just to have a break in the middle of all this right now.
Ah, that's good. That's good. Yeah. Well, enjoy the rest of your holiday.
Thank you, Martin. It's an honor to be on your show. Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Thanks a lot.
All right, take care.
See you again. Bye-bye. So I hope you enjoyed that. It was, I've got to tell you, it was a lot of fun recording and, you know, a pleasure to have Rick on the show. So, you know, it's already going to be a long podcast for you, so I'm not going to go into any details about anything else today. We'll just we'll wrap it up there. So you have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.
PhotoCastNetwork.com, your photography resource in the podosphere. PhotoCastNetwork.com.